Highs in the low 70s.
Good morning. It's hard to stay popular while in power in a democracy right now. Sliding approval ratings have forced British Prime Minister Keir Starmer to resign. What are the next steps? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump's first vice president has a critique of Trump's second term. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Vice President Mike Pence takes issue with the populist right in a book that he calls What Conservatives Believe. In the years since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, the number of abortions has sharply increased. Why? Also, we assess Iran negotiations with Democratic lawmaker Adam Smith. It's Monday, June 22nd. This day, 1 year ago, U.S. forces attacked Iran's underground uranium enrichment facilities. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Vice President Vance has concluded the first round of high-level talks with Iranian officials in Switzerland. The mediators are Pakistan and Qatar. Officials from these two countries say technical teams from Iran and the U.S. will go on talking about the details of the preliminary agreement. NPR's Aya Batrawi has more.
Mediators say technical talks on Iran's nuclear program and U.S. sanctions are continuing through the week in Switzerland in order to reach a final deal within 60 days. They say the U.S. and Iran also agreed to create a, quote, deconfliction cell to ensure a ceasefire in Lebanon holds. This comes after high-level talks concluded in Switzerland in what mediators say was a, quote, positive and constructive atmosphere. Those talks almost didn't happen. Iran's delegation refused to meet Vance due to Israeli attacks on southern Lebanon. Iran then said it was closing the Strait of Hormuz, and President Trump threatened the U.S. could resume attacks on Iran. But by Sunday, the two sides were sitting down for talks, and there were no new attacks between Iran-backed Hezbollah and Israel in Lebanon. Aya Beltrawi, NPR News, Dubai.
There's been a change this morning in British politics. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer says he is going to step down as head of his party, which means he'll quit being Prime Minister.
Every decision I've taken has been about putting the country I love first. That is why I will resign as leader of the Labour Party. I have spoken to His Majesty the King this morning to inform him of my decision.
Critics have battered Starmer over his decision to choose a friend of late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein as the UK ambassador to the United States and failure to deliver the change that British voters sought. Now, the former mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, says he will seek leadership in the Labour Party in an effort to become the next UK Prime Minister. Burnham just won a special election to Parliament, making him eligible to run for the higher position. China has imposed restrictions on dozens of U.S. companies. That includes American companies that produce rare earths. NPR's Jennifer Pack reports China is retaliating for recent U.S. measures against Chinese firms.
2 weeks ago, the Pentagon expanded a list that bars some Chinese companies from doing business with the U.S. military, saying the firms have links to the Chinese army. The list includes Chinese tech giants Alibaba, Baidu, and EV maker BYD, companies that have denied links to China's military. In response, China is placing 10 U.S. defense contractors, including drone makers and rare earth producers, on an export control list. It bans exporters from selling Chinese products that have dual-use purposes, meaning both military and non-military applications, to the sanctioned U.S. firms. 46 other American companies are also barred from participating in Chinese government procurement projects. Jennifer Pack, NPR News, Beijing.
This is NPR. There are primary elections in three states tomorrow, Maryland, New York, and Utah. South Carolina will have a runoff vote. That's for the Republican gubernatorial nomination. South Carolina Lieutenant Governor Pamela Evatt is endorsed by President Trump. She will face State Attorney General Alan Wilson for the GOP nomination. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is drawing about $100 million in emergency funding from a U.S. program that fights infectious diseases. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel reports the money will help the agency respond to the Ebola outbreak in Africa.
The CDC currently has more than 125 staff in the Ebola-affected countries, says Dr. Satish Pillai of the CDC in a press conference.
In the past several days, our team in DRC is collaborating in efforts to improve community acceptance of surveillance, isolation, and safe and dignified burials.
The U.S. is also supporting Ebola assessments at ports of entry, including airports, and providing technical input on how to get Ebola testing where it's needed. This boost in funding comes as the U.S. has faced criticism that foreign aid cuts may have hurt the region's ability to detect and respond to this Ebola outbreak. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
Forecasters have posted heat advisories from West Texas through southern New Mexico today. There are extreme heat watches posted for Phoenix and parts of southern Arizona as well. It could reach well into the triple digits there today. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact, and the Doris Duke Foundation.
When you tune into KEXC, you'll hear our phonology students reminding us to pay attention to nature.
Hello from Mr. Masakovic's class at Baxter Elementary School. This past week brought our first substantial rainfall on one day.
Canadian thistle has popped up.
Greetings from the fourth grade phonology team in the Linwood School Forest. This is Eliza,
Charlie, and Mary
reporting on our observations for the week ending May 1st.
This week, we observed our lilac have many sets of leaves on it.
Hi, this is Carson
and Reese from Crooked Lake Elementary School in Andover, reporting from Long Lake Conservation Center for April 29th through May 1st. The weather was sunny but cool with a high temperature of 48 degrees Fahrenheit.
This concludes the phonology report. Have a great week and be observant.
Keep exploring, keep discovering, and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
KEXC celebrating 50 years of people-powered radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Negotiators from the U.S. and Iran say they have concluded an initial phase of discussions over the details of a peace agreement between the U.S. and Iran. Here's Vice President J.D. Vance before the talks began.
The question before us now is how much more can we accomplish together? Can we turn over a new leaf? Can we change relations in the Middle East permanently?
In a few minutes, we'll talk about the negotiations with the top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee. But first, NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson is with us to tell us more about the political stakes for Trump in this moment. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning.
How is this memorandum of understanding playing in the U.S. so far?
Well, Trump is struggling to sell it. He's getting criticism from both wings of his own party. There are some in the Make America Great Again MAGA base who are angry that he went to war in the first place. Many of them voted for him because he promised not to get involved in any more foreign wars. And they don't feel like the U.S. has achieved anything of value so far. Then there are conservative Iran hawks in the GOP who feel the deal is weak, that it doesn't do any better than a deal made by former President Barack Obama, which Trump has criticized bitterly. And they also say that Trump's stated goals in the war haven't been met. There's certainly been no unconditional surrender, no regime change. Iran gets hundreds of millions of dollars in unfrozen assets. And so far, there's nothing to stop Iran from enriching uranium or building a nuclear weapon.
Has Trump responded to this criticism? How is he taking this?
Well, he's not very happy about it. He called his critics stupid and bad people. He was particularly angry about a New York Times headline that he actually reposted on social media. The headline said, quote, "What changed after almost 4 months of war? Analysts say not much." And Trump went on to say that the Iranian Air Force is gone, its military is decimated, its leaders were killed. And all that is true, but it also appears that Iran took a beating, but the regime is still in place, arguably more hardline than the previous one. And Iran has been able to deploy a powerful new weapon they never used before, closing the Strait of Hormuz, and that's given them leverage over the world economy.
So why make a deal now? I mean, what is at stake for President Trump and his party?
The short answer is the U.S. economy. The economic pressure, once the Strait of Hormuz was closed and prices went up, seems to have pushed Trump to make this deal. And when he signed it last week in France, he said he didn't want to be like former President Herbert Hoover. Here's what he said.
So rather than possibly going into a depression, rather than having your favorite president be Herbert Hoover, I was always the one I didn't want to be.
So Trump is being very transparent. He doesn't want to be seen as responsible for inflation rising. He's basically telling the world and his opponents what his pain point is, which is $4 a gallon gasoline.
So just in the couple of minutes we have left here, Mara, what greeted Trump back in Washington when he returned from signing that tentative deal with Iran?
Well, one thing he found was the reflecting pool at the Lincoln Memorial was full of green, slimy algae and peeling blue paint. That happened maybe because the pool is now absorbing more sunlight and heat after Trump had its bottom painted dark blue. So you could see that green algae and peeling blue paint as a metaphor for Trump's troubles getting the world to follow his orders, or you could see it as just a temporary blip as he makes Washington, D.C. more beautiful.
At least in his eyes.
In his eyes.
That is NPR's Mara Liasson. Mara, thank you.
You're welcome.
We're with you live this morning. Vice President Vance has been talking with the media in Switzerland today. He is preparing to duck out of the talks there and leave them to experts to continue. And we're going to work this through with Representative Adam Smith of Washington State. He's the top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee. Representative Smith, welcome back.
All right. Thanks for having me on, Steve. I appreciate the chance.
I've been taking some notes as Vice President Vance has been speaking the last little bit. He said that they'd made a lot of great progress on setting up the process. The technical talks will continue over the weeks and days to come. But he then goes on to say, I can't stay here for 60 days, the period where they're supposed to work everything out. But he says we laid a good foundation for a successful deal. That is his analysis of what's happening. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's really important that we end this war. I mean, it was a disastrous decision to go into it in the first place, you know, and certainly we can analyze that, but we are where we are. So the question is, what's the next best step? Does it make sense to keep trading bombing campaigns, to have Iran shutting down the Strait of Hormuz? No, it doesn't. We need to negotiate the best deal we can to get the strait back open and hopefully have something in place that enables us to deter Iran and the aggressive behavior that, you know, caused the conflict in the first place. But this really shows why the war and the idea that somehow military force was going to bend Iran to our will was a colossal mistake. And your previous report analyzed that. You know, now Iran knows they have the Strait of Hormuz as a major leverage point, and their regime is every little bit as hard line, and their nuclear weapons program has not gone away. So, but let's get to a better place. We need to stop this war. So I hope the negotiations can lead to that.
I want to ask about a phrase you said. You said the need was to set up some way to deter Iran from closing the Strait of Hormuz or doing whatever else they might want to do.
Yeah.
And I have a question about that. Over the weekend, the president continued to threaten Iran with various forms of destruction. But he has also said in recent days, as Mara told us, he said, I don't want to be Herbert Hoover. I don't want to have $4 gasoline. Can't do that again. When you admit that as president of the United States, do you lose all your leverage?
Yeah, well, you don't lose all of it. You certainly make it clear what you're not willing to do. And basically what he's not willing to do is what he did. It was just, you know, start the war and cause this chaos. But look, the incentive that remains for Iran is their economy is in shambles as well. And as hard line as their Iranian leadership is and how focused they are on sort of the revolution in power, they don't want their country to be, you know, an economic backwater either. So the threat going forward is that if this descends into another conflict of one kind or another, if we ramp up sanctions again, then Iran could pay a price. Look, this was always the leverage point we should have used instead of starting this war. You know, Iran had been substantially weakened. Hezbollah was weakened. Hamas was weakened. We had them in a very vulnerable place prior to the start of this war. But instead of pressing that advantage and negotiating the best possible deal, Trump entertained the fantasy that he could be the guy that would eliminate the Iranian regime and fundamentally remake the Middle East. And where have we heard that before? We are not going to fundamentally totally remake the Middle East with the use of our military, a lesson we should have learned in the previous two decades. So hopefully we've learned it now and we can negotiate the best possible deal. But there's no question that this war in Iran was a major strategic blunder that's had huge negative implications for us and for the global economy.
Now, as you recall, of course, Congressman, back in 2015, the United States made a nuclear agreement with Iran. It included $1.7 billion for the Iranian government. It was effectively their own money that was being returned to them or released to them. There were lots of objections about that at the time. But I guess my point here that's relevant is the Iranians agreed to that. They agreed to limitations on their nuclear program. Critics said they weren't that valuable or that strict, but they did agree to limitations. And it was a relatively small payment. Now the United States is talking about somewhere finding them hundreds of billions of dollars if they perform properly, if they restrict their nuclear program properly. Do you think there's plausible room for a big agreement here?
Well, there's room for it, but I think it points out the fact that whatever we do now is going to be worse than the JCPOA. The JCPOA was working. Iran was adhering to it. The inspectors were allowed in. And I think the other aspect of this, two things quickly. One, this is sort of Obama derangement syndrome. Because Obama negotiated the deal, every Republican thinks it has to be terrible. And look, as we move further and further towards this fact-free universe where my side is right and the other side is wrong no matter what, you make mistakes like this. You got to think through it. You know, sometimes your political opponent actually does something intelligent and you ought to acknowledge it instead of this knee-jerk partisan, the other side is always wrong. And I think that's what drove Trump to tear up the agreement. The other problem, of course, is Trump's not the only one who entertains the fantasy that somehow Iran can be eliminated. Benjamin Netanyahu entertains that fantasy too. He thinks he's going to be able to kill and vanquish all of his adversaries. Instead of making the peace deal that was there on the table prior to the start of this war, started that war, which of course kicked off the Lebanese war, and now Israel is trapped in this cycle of endless conflict. We're not going to eliminate Iran. We got to figure out a smart way to deter them. That's the bottom line.
I'm glad you bring up the idea of reflexive partisanship. We've seen a bit of a break from that in recent days because there are some Republicans, conservative Republicans, who really don't like this agreement, have a lot of questions about it, and are aware that there is a law that Congress has passed that would seem to require Congress to vote in some way, or at least give the opportunity for Congress to vote in some way on any nuclear agreement with Iran. A few days have passed. Are your Republicans who raised concerns still admitting they are concerned, and are they going to do anything about it?
Well, it's interesting because a couple of different layers. I mean, you do have a lot of Republicans, who are just going along with it no matter what. But the other problem here is, of course, a lot of the people who are disagreeing with Trump are the hawks. They're the ones who think, no, we can, in fact, fundamentally break Iran and we should keep trying.
Oh, their objection is there should be more war.
Well, I think their objection was sort of less logical than that. It's like, no, we want more. We should get more. It's unacceptable that Iran is doing these things. I hear people say it's unacceptable. Okay, well, it's unacceptable. What are you going to do about it? Is there an option on the table to actually change that? And they kidded themselves into thinking that if we just bombed enough, that would have that effect, but it won't. So you have to manage the world as it is, not as you want it to be. And I think a lot of the hawks are still imagining that world where if we just apply enough pressure to Iran, they will break. Again, Iran is a major threat. We have to figure out how to deter them, but thinking we're going to eliminate them is a problem. So I think we shouldn't have got into the war in the first place, but now the people are saying, well, let's just keep at it. I mean, what's the first rule of holes is when you're in one, stop digging. Mm. So I hope that's the lesson the Trump administration has learned.
Representative Adam Smith of Washington State, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
This is NPR News.
It is 6:19. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:30, Minnesota Native News. This week, we'll hear about Red Lake Nation's efforts to transfer back public portions of Upper Red Lake. And we'll hear about White Earth Nation and how they are expanding the harvest from its bison herd. We receive support from ICTV, providing information for and about Itasca County on Apple TV, Roku, and watchictv.org. We also thank North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. You can answer our question of the week. Summer is ramping up and the 4th of July is near. Is there a small town event or festival that you think everyone should experience? Do you have any great stories from a small town festival? Not necessarily just during the 4th of July, any time of the summer. You can text us at 218-326-1234. Coming up this Saturday, June 27th, it is Beltrami Block Party, co-hosted by KAXE, KBXE, Bridget's Pub, and Keg and Cork. It starts at 1 o'clock with free live music, featuring Eric Koskinen, David Huckfeldt, Little Fevers, and more, plus food and beverages on Beltrami Avenue. Find info at KAXE's Facebook page, made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Penn Medicine, committed to innovation since 1751. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine is working to change lives. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Strawberry.me, whose career coaches offer professional support to help people get unstuck, gain clarity, and move forward, whether advancing in a current role or choosing a new direction altogether. More at strawberry.me/public. And from the Public Welfare Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. For almost 20 years now, I've been following the career of Mike Pence.
You know, Steve, we both hail from Indiana. True.
He talked with NPR as a conservative House Republican, as vice president, and then as the former official who had refused President Trump's demand to help overturn the 2020 election. Pence's politics remained consistent while his party changed. Pence's latest book includes a critique of the second Trump administration and what he terms the populist right. His book, What Conservatives Believe, supports free trade and free markets while challenging Trump's tariffs and other interventions in the economy.
Well, from I think the very first instance when the new Trump administration announced that they were going to take shares in Nippon's purchase of U.S. steel, I was struck by the fact that Senator Elizabeth Warren said, and I quoted in my book, she said, "I think Donald Trump has come across an idea that I came up with years ago." But honestly, Steve, the idea of government ownership of private enterprise was not her idea. That Karl Marx actually came up with that.
Are you also concerned about what might be described as political favoritism of companies? The Ellisons, who were close supporters of the president, have received regulatory approval to create a giant media conglomerate. We could go on and on with examples, but that's one. What do you think?
Steve, I think it's one of the lesser reported aspects of the tariff regime that's been imposed by the administration is the granting of waivers to large corporations of certain tariffs means that small business America, small business Indiana, largely gets left out of the equation.
And these are waivers for companies that are close to the president. Is that the connection that you're making?
That I don't think there's any question, have access to the White House and are able to get some accommodation or consideration in that. You know, the foundation that I created, Advancing American Freedom, actually came up with a study about 6 months ago that in the first year of this administration, lobbying fees in Washington, D.C. had increased by tenfold. People that want to drain the swamp in Washington, D.C., there's maybe nothing more swampy than the battle over getting tariff waivers for big business. And I think you make a great point.
I want to ask about another aspect of your argument here. In listing what conservatives believe, you say conservatives believe that all men are created equal. Mm-hmm. Of course, you're quoting the Declaration of Independence, not very controversial. However, there is debate on the political right about the role and the future of men and women. When you say all men are created equal, do you include women?
Oh, of course, Steve. At our core, this nation, we'll remember in just a few weeks the signing of the Declaration of Independence 250 years ago. That principle that throughout mankind, that all men and women are created equal, derived from the belief among our founders that we're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And I just think as we celebrate the 250th anniversary, we do well to return to first principles.
There are some on the political right who have popularized the idea of one family, one vote. There's a man, there's a woman, there's children. The husband votes, the woman does not vote. You're smiling as I speak. What do you think of that idea?
Well, it's one person, one vote in this country, and people have bled and died for that principle. When it comes to the American family, there is a move among the populist right to expand government programs deep into the family to drive certain outcomes. I can tell you, as a father of three, the grandfather of five, what American families need is an application of the kind of principles that will create higher wages, more opportunities, more jobs, and I'm confident the American family will thrive.
There's another thing I want to ask about, because you clearly admire Barry Goldwater. You write about him in the opening pages of the book. He was an antecedent to Ronald Reagan. And there is one part of Goldwater's record that would seem suddenly to be relevant again. He voted against the Civil Rights Act of 1964 as a senator. The civil rights legislation in the 1960s is now being rejudged or relitigated before the Supreme Court. We're changing the rules as we speak for redistricting. It will affect this fall's elections. Should conservatives stand for civil rights?
Well, I think one of the greatest legislative accomplishments of the last century was the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Barry Goldwater, in his famous book, Conscience of a Conservative, that inspired my new book, voted against it, opposed it. But to his undying credit, he regretted that. The Supreme Court recently said that race cannot be taken into account when drawing congressional district lines, recognizing that the civil rights protections flow to the individual and not to drive outcomes. I support the legal foundation under that decision. But I really do believe that ensuring that we as conservatives are articulating that vision of equality of opportunity goes to the very heart of our movement.
I'm thinking about that Supreme Court ruling, which had to do with another 1960s law, this 1965 Voting Rights Act.
Right.
And the rules under which the federal government might mandate redistricting in a state that historically had districted black people out of power. And if I can summarize the court ruling, they're saying, actually, if you try to correct that, you're the racist. If you're creating a majority black district, you may be discriminating. And the legislature in this case is entirely free to do almost anything they want, so long as they say they were purely partisan. Is that really in line with the intent of the constitutional amendments underlying all this and in line with the 1965 Act?
Well, I think it's, if you understand that civil rights flow to the individual, my reading, and I haven't read the whole opinion, but my reading and my support for that decision is that the focus is on the individual and preserving the civil rights of individuals. And then allowing, I'm not a big fan of partisan gerrymandering, Steve, full disclosure, mm-hmm. but it's the system that we have, and just ensuring that race in no aspect plays a role in the partisan gerrymandering, I think is proper.
Mr. Vice President, thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Steve. Great to see you.
His new book is What Conservatives Believe. This is NPR News.
Firefighters are anticipating a busy summer in the West. The U.S. Forest Service says it is ahead of its hiring goals, but some Westerners are worried by downsizing at the agency.
These layoffs at the federal level are presenting risk as to our ability to respond to major wildfires.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Concerns over wildfire staffing on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered coming up at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXE. Andrew Dzinga will be your local host. Good morning. It is 6:29. I'm Jennifer Barr. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show. Coming up, we'll have Minnesota Native News and Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. And also before 7 o'clock, we've got an essay or a story from Susie Saxhog Loeffler that was told at to a live audience at Clocko Brewing at a recent storytelling for Spirit and Courage event. Then just after 7 o'clock, we've got a special edition of the Up North Report. Support for KAXE comes from Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Rich Mattson and Jermaine Gemberling tonight as part of the Martini Monday Music Series. Music begins at 5 o'clock. Reservations at 218-326-2600. Taking a look at our current temperatures, it is 45 in Aiken, 45 in Hibbing, 47 in Grand Rapids, 50 in Bagley, 46 in Bemidji. For today, mostly sunny, highs 72 to 75 with light and variable wind. Mostly cloudy tonight, lows 48 to 52, and then we have some rain moving in for the next few days. Tomorrow, chance of showers, possible thunderstorms, high 69 to 72, winds from the southeast 5 to 10, gusting higher. That chance of rain continues Tuesday night, overnight lows near 50, and then Wednesday, continued chance of rain, mostly cloudy with highs in the upper 60s. It's time now for Minnesota Native News.
You're listening to Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock. This week, a debate on an 1889 agreement involving Upper Red Lake sees a new update at the recent Minnesota DFL convention, and the White Earth Nation is harvesting meat from its bison. First, producer Chaz Wagner talked to a tribal leader and state official about the future of the waters of Upper Red Lake.
The waters of Upper Red Lake have long been home to the Red Lake Band of Ojibwe. At last month's Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor, or DFL, convention, delegates from around the state passed a resolution affirming treaty rights. The resolution specifically names returning the eastern half of Upper Red Lake and the Red Lake State Forest to the tribe.
This is not a new request or demand from the tribe, the Red Lake Band, and it came to the legislature 2 years ago.
Senator Mary Kunish represents parts of Ramsey, Hennepin, and Anoka counties. Red Lake Nation petitioned and worked with her to propose the legislation.
The gist of that bill was to require the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources to transfer state lands, not private lands, that are within a 1 mile buffer around the upper Red Lake and inside the Red Lake State Forest back to the band.
Opponents say the proposal raises major concerns about public access to hunting and fishing.
Non-native fishermen will still be able to access the portion of the upper lake that they are able to get to now. This only pertains to the state-owned lands.
Joe Plumer is legal counsel for the Red Lake Nation. He says that the dispute about Upper Red Lake goes back to 1889.
Well, it was the 1889 agreement that was made between the chiefs and what's known as the Chippewa Commission. And in order that they wouldn't be misunderstood, the chiefs literally drew what they were reserving as the reservation, and it included both lakes and the lands around it.
While delegates at this year's DFL convention supported the return of public sections of Upper Red Lake, Senator Kunish is cautiously optimistic that the state legislature will hear a similar bill again when it returns to session in January. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Chaz Wagner.
Next, White Earth Nation is solving a food crisis with an ancestral tradition. Producer CJ Younger has the story.
In just 2 years, the White Earth Nation's bison program has grown from 4 to 55 bison. They welcomed 45 new bison last year from the Intertribal Buffalo Council's annual surplus program, including 16 harvest animals. And in April, they began harvesting meat from two bison a month.
the vast majority is right now going into the elder nutrition program.
That's Jack Heisler, White Earth's bison foreman and White Earth Nation first generation descendant.
That meat is very nutritious. Some of the intentions are to provide a healthier protein source for our people, possibly reducing some diabetes numbers.
The meat is processed at B&T Meats in Waban. Some of the meat is reserved for powwows and ceremonies. A community harvest is in the works for later this year after the success of last year's event.
Everybody participated. Nearly everything from that animal was used, from medicinal uses, traditional different uses. There was nothing left at the end of that day.
The program was a dream for many years and began to take shape after challenges faced during the pandemic.
We need to start doing more sustainable food sources right here within our own boundaries and food sovereignty and security.
With 55 bison and more calves being born, the available pastures and resources are close to capacity, sparking conversations around expanding the program. White Earth is also working closely with the United States Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service to gather data on the impacts of returning bison, a key species in prairie ecosystems, to their native prairies.
They're a resilient, very resilient animal and often referred to in native country as our relative. Native people are resilient people.
For Minnesota Native News, I'm CJ Younger.
That's all for this week's episode. Join us next time for more voices and stories that inform, uplift, and shape our communities right here on Minnesota Native News. Minnesota Native News is produced by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
You can find more at MinnesotaNativeNews.org. 6:36, thanks for listening to KAXE and the Monday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock this morning, Heidi Holton is your host for Headwaters, and it is Monday, which means it's Request Line Day. And Heidi said, in honor of the World Cup, she wants to hear your favorite world music. Text in your song suggestions, 218-326-1234. And coming up this week on Headwaters, we're going to be looking forward to the Beltrami Block Party with conversations with Cage Jamber tomorrow and Lucy Michelle on Wednesday. So stay tuned for that coming up this week on Headwaters. Right now it is time to hear from Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. She is going to tell us more about her young blue jay that she cared for many years ago named Ludwig.
Ludwig thrived, but being raised by a human instead of within a blue jay family meant his education was different from what a normal blue jay would have. The first time he took a bath in the kitchen sink, he soaked himself so thoroughly that every flight feather became a sodden, stringy, heavy mess. He hopped up to the edge of the sink with no problem, but when he tried to fly across the room to the table, he dropped to the floor like a rock. I picked him up on my finger and he stayed put while preening to dry off. Even with me patting him with paper towels, it took half an hour to restore his feathers to flying condition. I learned that there was no way I'd qualify for state and federal permits to keep Ludwig permanently, so as soon as he started to take short flights, I started taking him outdoors to help him learn some of the skills he'd need to become independent. I was terrified the first time I set him in the branches of a bush. What if he flew off and I never saw him again? How would he survive? I realized that parent birds easily keep track of their fledglings and can reach them even in the highest trees, but I was a mere human. Fortunately, fledglings also keep track of their parents. The first week or so, Ludwig never strayed far from me. For the first few days when I couldn't stay out with him, he'd happily come inside with me. As he got more independent, especially after he discovered mulberries in the back of the yard and delectable fruits further afield in the neighborhood, he'd spend minutes and then hours on his own. A family of blue jays lived somewhere near us, and whenever Ludwig found himself on their territory, the adults would chase him off, sometimes following him a ways. He quickly discovered that they were afraid of me. Now, when I was outside, he'd occasionally taunt them, getting them to chase him into our yard. He'd alight on my head and turn to face him as if saying, "My mom's bigger than your mom." As their own babies grew more independent, the adults grew tolerant of Ludwig. In the evening, or when rain was imminent, I'd call for him from the yard. Once I noticed my neighbor staring at me, making me feel like Samantha on the TV show Bewitched, when she'd call, "Mother, Mother," into the bushes. Calling "Ludwig, Ludwig" seemed even more bizarre. Sometimes I couldn't wait for him and went inside. When he was ready to come in, he'd look through our basement apartment windows until he saw us, and he'd peck at the glass to catch our attention. By this time, he was also starting at long last to make blue jay vocalizations. Now, when he wanted my attention, he'd make a squawk that sounded like, "Ma! Ma!" which I, of course, found hilarious. Late one afternoon, a huge storm blew in while Ludwig was outside. As ominously dark clouds built up, I searched for him and called, but he did not come. This was the kind of rainstorm that starts out with a huge cloudburst, so I gave up and went inside. Every lightning bolt and blast of thunder made me more anxious. When the rain finally stopped, I ran out and called for Ludwig. I couldn't find him in my own yard or nearby, so I hopped on my bike and started riding through the neighborhood calling his name. Finally, a few blocks away, I found him sitting on a telephone wire directly above a bus stop, feathers so plastered against his body that he didn't look anything like a blue jay, just a gray, sodden mass squawking, "Ma! Ma!" A dozen or so people were waiting for the bus as I pulled my bike to a stop. That was back when I still clung to a shred of a sense of dignity, and I felt my face grow hot as I called, "Come on down, Ludwig." He dropped like a rock, fortunately, onto the slim strip of grass between the sidewalk and the curb. He hopped up to me yelling, "Ma! Ma!" as the people at the bus stop stared and laughed. Thanks to the spunky little blue jay, what was left of my sense of dignity was fading away. That internal radar system, so desperately focused on any sign of disapproval or ridicule, makes it hard for many people to follow their own lights. We can get so wrapped up in self-consciousness that we forget that absurdities are part of everybody's life. We need to outgrow that to become our genuine selves, which, intriguingly, means to become more like blue jays. That was one of the important lessons I took from those magical days with Ludwig. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.
You can read more about Ludwig at lauraerickson.com. She's got some photos there as well of that blue jay she took care of many, many years ago.
Okay. It's an interesting story we were hearing there. Yeah.
Yeah. It is 6:43. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy, and it's the Monday morning show on KAXE.
Good morning. Today, it looks like it'll be mostly sunny with highs 72 to 75, light and variable wind. Tonight, mostly cloudy, lows 48 to 52 degrees. With tomorrow, we're looking at a chance of showers, possible thunderstorms, high 69 to 72 with a southeast wind 5 to 10 miles per hour gusting higher. Rain likely Tuesday night with overnight lows near 50. And then Wednesday, there's a chance of rain that continues, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 60s.
Steve, our question of the week is all about small town festivals. As summer's ramping up, we've got the 4th of July less than 2 weeks away now, but we want to hear about those small town festivals, whether or not they take place around the 4th. They kind of are spread out all summer throughout our region. Want to know if you've got a favorite one, if you've got any fun stories from being at one, text us at 218-326-1234. We heard from some of our fellow staff members. DJ Dang says Nevis Muskie Days is always wonderfully weird. And Sarah Bignall says Bovee Farmer's Day is always a good time.
Okay.
So I'd love to hear from you. Text us at 218-326-1234.
I'll especially be looking for these because I've only lived here for, you know, 4 or 5 years. So I'm not too familiar with what's going on in the region as far as, you know, local festivals and things like that. I've been to the Tall Timber Days here in Grand Rapids. And but beyond that, I'll be looking forward to hearing about what goes on for festivals here.
Yeah, and you can always check out Events Up North at our website for a list of events each week. You know, not just the small town festivals, but all kinds of things going on. And then soon our news team is working on their annual 4th of July fireworks map. So check that out. That'll be coming soon.
Yeah.
And yeah, lots to do. And if you think we may not be aware of something going on, please send us an email, whether, you know, either way, we'd love to hear about it. PSA@KAXE.org. Up next, we are going to hear from Susie Saxhog Loeffler. She is active in community theater, and she recently told the story of her acting career to a live audience at Clockow Brewing in a concert of storytelling for spirit and courage.
Has anybody been to see The Wizard of Oz yet up at the Reif? Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. I was there for opening night last night with my daughter, and she was texting her boyfriend the cast list because they all went to high school together. And she said, oh, so-and-so's in it. And he wrote back and he said, well, of course he is. And I looked at Emily and I said, you know, that's how people talked about me in high school, right? Because before I was Susie Loeffler, fourth grade teacher, I was Susie Saxhog growing up in the Grand Rapids Players. And I tried out for everything from second grade on. And there wasn't such a thing as not getting in the play for the most part, because there's always a chorus and you can always use a small child. I didn't always get the part that I wanted, but I always got in the play. And so eventually I thought, well, I should probably do this for a living, as you do. And so I decided I was going to be a theater major at college. You'll notice I'm not an actor now. That's important when you're talking about spirit and courage, because the spirit might be strong and the courage might be strong, but there are other things that happen on your way to being an actor or a teacher. In fact, there were several people in Grand Rapids who thought maybe I should prepare for one while I was preparing for another. But I wasn't very happy with those people. Because you never are when you're 17 and 18 and shooting for your dream, right? Why would I need a backup plan? That's ridiculous. Besides, I loved auditioning. Auditioning is a lot like interviewing for a job. So all of us have done it, right? You have a chance to go in and show people how amazing you are. And I was constantly told as a small child that I was amazing. So why wouldn't I go out to the great big world for them to tell me that too? So I went to a small liberal arts college. It's important to note that I did not choose to go to a conservatory acting program that I would have to audition to get into. I think this story would have gone differently. But I chose to go to a liberal arts college because learning is important, and it's important to be well-rounded. And also those conservatory programs told you that you couldn't get on stage for 3 years. And I was not having that. So I went to McAllister College, beautiful theater department. They don't do musicals, which was a little bit of a shock for me, but that's okay. I learned a lot of really weird theater there, and I auditioned for my first big show there the fall of my first year of college. And I was nervous because I didn't know any of the directors except for the one that taught my acting class, but she wasn't directing this show. So I dragged some friends along with me. You know why that's a mistake? I bet you can guess. The friend got cast. I did not. I know. But the director did remember me. And then when the spring came around and the intro to directing class had to audition actors to be in their small short plays, I got cast in a couple of those. And that was really exciting because I did get to go on stage. And I was appreciated by who I was hoping would become my peers. So that was really positive. And I went out of my first year of college thinking, okay, I'm on the way. I'm on the way. I'm going to succeed here. Sophomore year, we had these classes in the theater department where the whole semester was about studying this one play and all its influences, and then you actually put on the show. So you knew if you took the class, you got to be in the show. And it just so happened that the four major parts of the play were voice parts. Voice is something I can do. So that same director that directed the first year play directed this one. And so then I was on his radar, happened to be chair of the department. So we got all the way through sophomore year and I was feeling very successful. So I decided, let's go abroad and study in London. Great idea. Great idea, because definitely the whole world was going to find out how amazing I was. So this first 6 weeks of the program was fantastic. We got to study under dance people and professional actors in London and different body work and mask work. And we all did it in a group. And so there wasn't any auditioning. There was just practicing and performing for each other. And it was great. And I made really good friends. Any Kate and Allie fans out there? Anybody remember that show, Kate and Allie? Okay, you remember that little boy, Chip? Okay, maybe not, but he was my best friend. And that was a big deal. But the last 4 weeks of the program, you tried out for three directors and you got cast in their play. Yes, everybody got cast in a play. The director who cast me, his name was Simon Stokes, and he was one of the founders of the Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago. Yeah, very cool. He knew John Malkovich. And so he cast me, and that was great. But then we had to go through the process of actually casting the parts for the show after he got his group. And that's where it started to fall apart. I got sick. It was the 90s, and I was a theater major, so I was smoking like a pack a day. I don't smoke anymore, and my mom already knows this, so don't worry about it. But I got bronchitis, and then I got bronchitis twice. And by the time we got around to actually auditioning for Simon, I wasn't my full self. And so I got a very small part in the play. And when it came to the end of everything, and we were having our post-mortem on the show, he looked at me in the face and he said, I didn't know you were good, because you didn't show me in auditions. And I thought, I always thought auditioning was the thing I was good at. So that was a little bit of a blow. And so when I came back to McAllister, after getting the blow in London from Simon Stokes, my confidence was a little dinged up. And then it turned out that the spring play was cast before we got back. So I wasn't going to be in the spring play. Okay, that's fine. Intro directing was still going on, so I could try out for my friends, because now all my friends were in intro to directing, so they would give me a part, right? So I walked in. I walked into that theater and I was confident. I said hi to all my friends and I did a good reading. And then I said something sassy like, so will we hear from you tonight? Guess who decided that I needed to be put in my place? So I didn't get cast for the spring director projects. And then I decided that it would be a great idea to go to a cattle call audition for the musical Rent. Do you know what a cattle call audition is? It's what it sounds like. About 1,500 actors from all over the cities show up at the Ordway and get, you know, those fences that the cattle get routed through when they're gonna have inoculations or whatever? Yeah, we got that. All the way outside the doors and then into the doors and then around the lobby and then up the stairs and then into small little rooms. I mean, closet-sized rooms where they have a guy on a piano and then a guy here and then a guy with a camera. And you audition and you have about 3 minutes. Well, it's Rent, so I thought, well, I can't sing Climb Every Mountain for Rent. So, you know that Celine Dion song, It's All Coming Back to Me Now? It's all coming back, it's coming back to me now. No, nobody? Yes? Yes? Okay. All right. But you only have 3 minutes, so you really need to hit the good part, right? So you know the part in the song where she goes, baby, 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 you know that part? Yep, that's what I started with. Pretty much what I ended with, the guy was like, okay, thanks, and I left. The camera was actually from a news station doing a story on the cattle call rent auditions that were coming to the Twin Cities. And when I got back to campus, I heard that I was on the news getting rejected. Yeah. So, junior year was tough. Senior year was better. That same director that put me in the weird show for my voice decided that since he had a couple of singers in this class, that we would actually do a musical for my senior year. So it was wonderful. We did the 1940s radio hour. It was the best. My mother came for 8 separate performances. It was really something. But I came out of college with slightly less confidence than going in. But I couldn't give up, right? You can't come out with a theater degree and then say, well, I can't do this. So I said, I'm going to start auditioning because that's what you do. And I got a waitressing job because that's what you do. But then at some point, my uncle pointed out to me that maybe I was just a waitress. He wasn't being mean. He just noticed I hadn't actually auditioned for anything. Because auditioning was hard. And it was painful. And nobody tells you how wonderful you are in the real world. That's home. That's home. What I did find a couple of years after I graduated from college was a local community theater in White Bear Lake. Has anybody ever been to Lakeshore Players in White Bear Lake? Oh, such a great group of people. And at that point, they were still performing in that church. In that old church. And so I got to do Sweet Charity, played a French hooker. That's right. And then we did Nonsense, and I got to be a nun just like my mom. And I thought, well, maybe what I'm really good at can still be appreciated even if it's not the only thing that I do, right? Because besides being on stage, the other part of me that had always pictured myself in front of a group of people. Those people were all very, very small and laughed at all my jokes, right? So eventually, I talked Dan into coming back up here. And I don't want you to think that it's a big fish in a small pond situation. I still got rejected for parts here or was put in the chorus instead of having a big part. That still happens to me here. But what also happens to me here is that I feel appreciated, and I feel wanted, and I feel like I can go on, and I can keep trying for things, whether it's trying to get a teaching job, which took a while, or trying to be in Fiddler on the Roof. Yeah, and so I guess when Michael talked about stories of spirit and courage, this is what came to mind for me, because I fought through a lot of self-doubt and a lot of thinking that I wasn't the person that I thought I was. But it turns out that the person I thought I was lives in Grand Rapids. Thank you.
Susie Saxhog-Loeffler at a storytelling event supported in part by an artist equity grant from Arrowhead Regional Arts Commission with support from the McKnight Foundation here on the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
Good morning. This is 91.7 KAXE in Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley-Bemidji, 89.9 in Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. Celebrating 50 years of people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at kaxe.org.
Coming up in just a few moments, we're going to have the Up North Report. And at 7:20, it's Events Up North. Steve and I will take a closer look at what's going on throughout the region this week. And at 7:45, what we're reading, our show all about books produced by our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski. Today, we'll hear from debut author Meg Charlton about her novel Voyagers, exploring memory and the enduring power of friendship at the end of the world.
KAXE, KBXE, Bridget's Pub, and Keg and Cork host the Beltrami Block Party in downtown Bemidji Saturday, June 27th, starting at 1 p.m. Free live music with Eric Koskinen, David Huckfeldt, Little Fevers, and more, as well as food and beverages on Beltrami Avenue. Info at KAXE's Facebook